News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to Hometown Heroes with you on Saturday afternoons here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. I am Paul Leffler, and yes, there is a Bulldog football game tonight against San Jose State. Our pregame coverage will start at 4:30. But for the next hour, we're going to take that weekly trip back in time and talk about the World War II era with a veteran who has a very interesting story. I think you'll hear some things that you've probably never heard before. But before I get to today's guest, Kenneth Lopke of Woodland, just a couple of notes. Please keep Staff Sergeant Christian Hughes and his family in your prayers. If you've been listening to KMJ, you've heard about his situation, a vicious, cowardly attack in Afghanistan by someone they thought was a friend who turned out to be a foe, but he has survived that. He's undergone several operations at Walter Reed Medical Center, and we continue to pray for his family. His mother, Barbara Peace, is very involved with the local chapter of the Central Valley Blue Star Moms, who you've heard me talk about. You can find out more information about their efforts at centralvalleybluestarmoms.org if you're interested in that. Also, a couple of concerts coming up. You've heard me talk about the New Horizons Band locally, people that are all over 50 learning music for the first time. You've heard those commercials, and I do want to tell you there's a concert coming up October 28th. You can find out more information about that and some special workshops with the U.S. Marine Band coming to town this week. That information is on my page at kmjnow.com. Okay, now let's get on to the business at hand. Today's guest, Kenneth Lopke of Woodland, is 87 years old, and he has a very incredible story, if I do say so myself. He might not say so. None of my guests ever do, but I sure think so, and I think you will, too, by the end of this program. Mr. Lopke, thanks so much for being with us today. And first of all, let's talk briefly about how you ended up on this program. It was an old high school classmate or hometown friend of yours that I had on the show a couple months back, Laverne Mack, and you heard about this through him?
Yes, that's right. He called me up and told me that he had been interviewed by you, and then we began to talk about our experiences, and I had never really talked to him before about where he was and what he really did out in the South Pacific. I knew he was interested in radio, and so that's how it started.
So you two found out that you were in some of the same places around the same time, and you're both from a small town in South Dakota, right?
That's right.
What was the name of that town again?
That's Leola.
Leola, South Dakota.
Yeah, it's right near the North Dakota-South Dakota border in kind of central northern South Dakota.
And now you live in Woodland, which is near Sacramento, but when you were there in Leola, South Dakota, I imagine that's where you were on December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day and how you heard that the United States was now at war?
My father had come home from church, and he had told us that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. We didn't have a radio because the battery was probably dead, and he probably brought it home from town being charged at the gas station.
Well, those were the days. That's how it worked back then. So did you have an inkling at that point that the military was going to be in your future?
Well, they were already drafting people then. Some of our neighbors were drafted in the 40s already, and they were gone away to serve the country, and so I figured it was going to be coming.
And by this time, you're already 19 years old, right?
Yeah, about that.
So did you decide to enlist before they drafted you?
No. We lived on the farm, and it was short of help. We got deferments as farm workers because there was so many of the young people were gone. And if there was only one son in the family, he was left home there to help as long as he could. And then when the war finally got around to where it was turning our way, why, by then they began drafting everybody. So I didn't get drafted until December of 1944.
Well, that was pretty late in the war, but in the short time that you had to get overseas, you were involved in some pretty memorable things. I know by the time this program is over, we're going to talk about General MacArthur. We're going to talk about your interactions with Japanese prisoners who were accused of war crimes and your interactions with American prisoners of war, telling you what the Japanese had done to them. And I know it's some incredible material that we're going to cover in this program. But so you're drafted in December 1944, and tell me about your early days in the Army. A lot of guys talk about a wake-up call and having to grow up real fast. Maybe a little different for you since you'd had to grow up on the farm and be responsible for so much already in your life?
Oh, yeah. I kind of enjoyed the basic training I took, which was in Camp Robinson, Arkansas. And I think we had 13 or 14 weeks of, or 16 weeks of basic training, and then we come home for a little furlough, and then we came out to Fort Ord near Monterey. Mm-hmm. We did some more training there, and then we left there to Camp Stoneman up near Pittsburgh, and from there we went down the Sacramento River in a boat to San Francisco and got on a Liberty ship, and away we went out into the Pacific.
I haven't heard too many guests on this show say that they enjoyed basic training, so that's a new one. But I guess if you grew up on the farm, maybe basic training allows you to sleep in a little bit.
Well, not really. What I enjoyed about it is because a lot of the fellows, you know, they weren't used to physical exercise, and I just ate that up. You know, that was a big deal.
That was fun. And by this time, when you're shipping out, you're 22 years old. It's about the time in a man's life that he's looking for a girlfriend, maybe having a girlfriend, finding a sweetheart, thinking about maybe getting married at some point. I think that you had someone like that in mind already, didn't you?
Yes, my present wife just lived over the hill from us, and I started going with her when she was about 18 years old, and I was about 20 or something like that.
So this was a tough goodbye when you had to leave Leola, South Dakota, and head off to war.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah, it was.
Something tells me she wrote you a letter or two.
Oh, lots of them. And I wrote her lots of them. And sometimes they were 6 weeks catching up with me because I moved around so much.
So you get a whole basket full of them all at once?
I get a whole batch, and she would get a whole batch.
Now, be honest with me here. When you left, when you got on that ship in San Francisco and you headed across the Pacific, were you 100% sure you were coming home, or was there some question in your mind that you may never see her again?
Well, you know, we kind of never thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the training kind of, I don't know, it did something to you that is kind of hard to describe. And we really, being young like that, you know, you don't think about that, but I always imagined I would get home. I know that the saddest day in my life was when we went under the Golden Gate Bridge, and the happiest day was when I came back under it home.
Not a whole lot of people can say that, and I absolutely believe you when you say it. Well, I guess there's one important question when we talk about this romance that is still going strong more than six decades later. Did you ask her to marry you before you left for war, or was that going to have to wait?
No, I waited with that until I got home.
All right. Well, we'll get to that when the chronological order allows us to. Right now, let's take our first break. When we come back, we'll talk about what things were like once you got across the Pacific to the other side of the world, to the war zone. Kenneth Lopke of Woodland is our guest today. We'll be right back with more of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Remember that? Kay Kaiser, Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. Our guest today, Kenneth Lopke, sure remembers it. Not necessarily one that he and his sweetheart Adeline might have danced to, I don't know, but certainly one that entertained the troops. As he told us, he headed out from San Francisco toward the Pacific. And what was the first place that you went to? And I imagine you had no idea where you were going, but you landed in the Philippines, right?
Yes. The first place we stopped at was Honolulu. We left from San Francisco unescorted, and then at Honolulu, we picked up a convoy of ships with cruisers and all that stuff guarding us, and we headed out for Aniwetok Harbor, which was about a week's sailing from Honolulu, and then the ship broke down. And we sat in the harbor for over 2 weeks waiting to get repairs. And there had been rumors that we were heading for Okinawa, where heavy fighting was going on.
And you were replacement troops, right?
We were replacement troops. And so being the ship broke down, we were lucky, and we ended up finally at Leyte in the Philippines, where all the fighting had stopped.
Now, this is one of those things that amazes me, and the way you just described it is very matter-of-fact, and there's so many veterans who can tell similar stories, but it just amazes me to look back and see those little twists of fate that all add up to you being able to sit and talk to me right now about it. And
yeah.
Just the fact that the ship broke down may have saved your life or many of those soldiers' lives at that point. And we can look back now and say that the end of the war was getting near. In less than a year, it would all be over. But at the time, you didn't know that. I'm sure you, as you went into this, were going into an uncertain future, right?
That's right.
What were some of the things that you did? I'm sure it's a little unsettling to not know where you're going, to not know what you're going to find when you get there. What were some of the things that helped you keep your sanity as you made that long trip and then and sat around and waited to see what was going to happen?
Well, I was lucky. I had another friend from my hometown who we stayed together all through the basic training and getting on the ship together. And so we spent a lot of hours together playing poker and cards on deck on the ship. And that helped us, you know, get to where we were going finally. And when we were at Leyte, like I told you, I didn't know that Laverne was there, and he didn't know that I was there.
You could have had a Loyola, South Dakota reunion in Leyte if you had
known
about
He had looked up a cousin of his,
uh-huh.
which I knew also. And so when we were in Leyte and we were being interviewed and processed, my friend says, I'm going to try get into medics because he says my feet are so bad that I can't handle this, you know, vigorous
all the moving around, all the
all
activity.
All the moving around, mm-hmm. and I knew I was sunk to go to the infantry because I had been a squad leader and had trained to be an infant. Well, we parted ways. He went to the infantry, and I went to the artillery.
And that would be the 218th Field Artillery Battalion, part of the 41st Infantry Division?
That's where I went, but he went to the 77th Division, which was on another island.
Was that tough for you? to part ways?
Yeah, it was kind of because I had to make all new friends again. And
And I understand your duties were going to evolve quite a bit over the next year or so after that. But at that point, with the 218th, what were your duties? What was your understanding of what you were supposed to be doing?
Okay, I was classed as a cannoneer, and it took a crew of about six people to operate one large 155 howitzer.
Mm-hmm.
And with the projectile alone weighed 95 pounds,
whew,
not counting the powder that was used. But there was no casing to those. It had no shell casing, really. It was a projectile and powder.
Well, that'll keep you strong.
And when those things went off, the sound was, out of this world. It ruined my hearing then already.
Well, I was just going to comment. I'm surprised that you could hear me now if you had to endure that. I've met so many veterans who served in the artillery who, just like you say, their hearing was gone almost instantaneously after working around those kind of guns for any length of time.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that you can hear me today as we talk about it. So how long were you on one of those crews, and did you see some action in that capacity?
No, the action was all over with in the Philippines when we arrived, everywhere.
Mm-hmm. So there quickly arose the need for you to do something else, I suppose.
Well, then, no, we began training then for the invasion of Japan.
That's right.
And we trained from about the second week in July until I think the bomb was dropped somewhere around the 6th or
the first bomb,
August.
Yeah, it was.
And then we stopped training and waited for ships to take us up to Japan.
So when you were training to invade Japan, did you know that that was what you were training for?
I found out later when we were going to invade Japan. And
so they gave you an actual date.
At that time, I didn't know when we were going to go.
And we've talked on this program before with many guests that the official estimates by the U.S. Army, if the United States had invaded Japan, it probably would have cost close to 1 million American lives, not to mention millions of Japanese lives. Obviously, I know you're very grateful you didn't have to do that. But you actually saw a date, right, where they said this is when you were going to invade Japan. What was that date?
I think it was on my birthday, the 26th of August.
Some birthday present that would have been.
That's for sure.
So you were fairly relieved when you heard the news about the bombs being dropped.
Yes, I was very happy that it was finally over.
So that's something else, another moment where you were spared, so to speak, by that chain of events. And I think the most interesting days of your time in the military were still ahead. The war may have been over, but your time in the service was far from over. Once the Japanese surrendered, is that when they found out that you could type a little bit?
Well, it was on my resume that I could type. I only went through the eighth grade. I never went to high school. And when I got out of school, I worked around the farm there for a while. And then I had always was interested in typing, so my father gave me a little calf. He says, you raise that calf, and it's yours. So in the fall, we sold the calf, and I got $35 for this calf, and I bought a Royal typewriter. And it had instructions in there how to learn how to type, you know, without looking at the keyboard and all this. And so I got pretty good. And so that was one reason the Army knew I could type.
And they decided they had a use for that.
Yeah.
What did they tell you? Where did they send you?
Well, when the 41st Division deactivated, we landed in Kure, Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the southern part of Honshu. And we didn't do much of anything there until they finally deactivated the division, and I went up to Nagoya Base Headquarters, and they put me in the Adjutant General's office, and here, do the correspondence for the general. So that was my start in the office work.
Which didn't sound, I'm sure the first time you heard that, it probably didn't sound all that exciting or interesting. It sounds fairly mundane, to put it like that.
Well, you had some interesting things went across your desk, you know, that nobody had access to. And I enjoyed it. And then, as I told you before, I edited and published the Daily Bulletin for the whole base. And I got an advance in rank there, and then that lasted till about April of 46, and then that was, the base was deactivated, and then I went up to Tokyo, Japan. Lo and behold, I landed in MacArthur's headquarters in a typing pool in the legal section, which was handling all the war crimes trials and anything pertaining to atrocities to American prisoners of war.
And that's what I think so many of our listeners are really going to be intrigued by. So I tell you what, we're going to take another break here. When we come back, I'm going to ask you about General MacArthur, because you had plenty of interaction with him. I'll ask you about the topic of some of those things you had to type up and your other duties, which I don't know if anyone would envy you for having to be in the shoes that you were in back in 1946. All the while, your sweetheart, Adeline, was sending you letters, and you were sending them right back. But we're going to pick up the story right there when we come back. Kenneth Lopke, our guest today. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Each week on this program, we visit with veterans of World War II. The idea behind that title, Hometown Heroes, is that you can find a hero in your hometown, no matter where you live in this great country of ours. And they don't want to be called heroes, but I think we can look at our greatest generation and thank those men and women, the more than 16 million Americans who served our country during World War II. Thank them for their service, for their sacrifice, to honor their commitment to our country, for paying the price for the freedom that we enjoy today. We try to preserve some of those stories and hopefully along the way get inspired by some of what they're sharing with us. Definitely get a little educated. I've learned so much from the veterans that have been on this show, and we're going to learn a little more today. A twist that I don't know if we've ever heard before on this program, the very interesting work that Kenneth Lopke of Woodland had to do in Japan in 1946. When we left off, he told us he had been transferred to Tokyo working in General Douglas MacArthur's office. Now, I'm sure, as a boy, a farm boy growing up in South Dakota, after the war got underway, I'm sure you had heard plenty about General Douglas MacArthur. Was he almost a larger-than-life figure for you when you went to work there in Tokyo under him?
Oh, yeah. One of the first things we did was to go down and stand in front of the Daiichi building and wait for him to come out, which he did every day at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I did not work in his office, but I had some roommates who worked in his office, and they told me about him, what he was like and what he did every day.
And you would see him come and go every day, and I understand you weren't the only one sometimes waiting for him. There was a large crowd of Japanese onlookers who had come to try to get a glimpse of him?
Oh, yes, lots of them.
He was a pretty popular figure at the time, I suppose.
Oh, yeah.
Is the stereotype that we get today of MacArthur, and he's such a complex figure and had a very roller coaster career in the U.S. military, but would you say that the reputation in general that he carries was an accurate one as far as you understood and witnessed?
I would say it was pretty accurate. He really got Japan on its feet after the war, which a lot of other people couldn't have done, I don't think. But although some of his military strategy I didn't approve of, but that's for me to say.
Well, and you weren't alone in that. The nickname Dugout Doug didn't come from nowhere. But you talk about MacArthur, and everyone, you know, thinks right away of that corncob pipe. Did he always have that in his mouth, or did you ever see him without it?
Well, most of the time he had it in his mouth. For his troops under the headquarters, he was very good to us. I mean, clothing regulations went right out the window. Mm-hmm. You could wear your shirt open at the neck, no tie, and lots of other units around that were under different commands. Their soldiers had to leave the bases with a tie and Ike jacket on and the whole nine yards. And for us in Tokyo, we had good quarters, we had good food, and really good jobs.
Well, you have a happy workforce. Maybe they don't complain so much. So I think he was a smart man in that regard. But I imagine when other bigwigs came through, maybe you had to dress up a little bit, and I understand that that was something that happened every once in a while. General Eisenhower came through, and you saw him?
Yeah, General Eisenhower visited our building, and I have a picture of him. I was maybe about 10 feet away from him, real handsome-looking general.
How much of an uproar around there did that cause? I imagine he got quite a bit of attention.
Yes, he visited not so much the headquarters of MacArthur, but he went out into the different units that were stationed around Tokyo. He visited the 1st Cavalry Division.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a story that he was reviewing the troops, and he stopped and he talked to this one soldier, and he says, "Soldier," he says, "what did you have for lunch?" And I don't remember what he said it was. And anyhow, the mess sergeant was following right along behind us. Oh, he said he had pork chops. And he said to the soldier, "Is that true, soldier?" And he says, "No." He says he had something like hamburger or hamburger on a slice of toast or something.
Which they have another name for, but we won't use it.
Yeah, that's right. And so then he told a soldier, he says, "If this ever happens again," he says, "you let me know." And he says, "I'll take some action."
That'll earn the admiration of your troops, no doubt about it. So here you are in Tokyo. Kenneth Lopke of Woodland is our guest today. He's 87 years old, a veteran of the U.S. Army during and after World War II, during the occupation of Japan. You've heard him talk about working under General MacArthur and how he witnessed General Eisenhower coming through as well. Now, during any of this time, since you'd been overseas, were you able to come home at all and see Adeline, or is it still strictly through the mail that you're corresponding?
No, strictly by letters.
So you're getting a little tired of being overseas, getting a little antsy to come home.
Yeah, but I wasn't over there as long as some of these poor guys were.
That's true. But I'm sure it weighed on your mind. And speaking of weighing on your mind, some of the material that you were asked to process, is, I imagine, as I try to put myself in your shoes, very hard to get out of your mind. Tell our listeners about some of the things that you had to document with regard to war crimes and the testimonies of American prisoners of war.
Yeah. Well, when the war ended, all of these people were released from the prisons and they were sent home. And after they were home, they were interrogated by the Army, and these people made out depositions of all the atrocities that were committed against them, the names of the people that did the atrocities, and then those depositions were sent to us in the legal section of MacArthur's headquarters, where we in the typing pool typed them out a stencil, and the stencils were then mimeographed, and probably 50 copies of each one of those depositions were sent to the War Crimes Tribunal down in Yokohama, where the war crimes trials were being held. And there's a couple of them that are outstanding that I remember. When they had the death march in down in the Philippines, these soldiers were marched down to Manila and were put on boats and shipped up to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these people were in the holds of these ships.
Hell ships.
With hardly any water.
Mm-hmm.
And they got a ball of rice about the size of an egg, I think once or twice a day to eat. That's all they had to eat. And then when they got up and they began dying in these holds, just like flies. Well, they would stack the dead soldiers up in the corner of the hold, and then at nighttime they were thrown overboard.
Mm.
And so only the strongest managed to make it up to Japan. Some of these people were so desperate for water, they drank their own urine.
Mm.
And those that survived, then they went and they put them out into various camps around Tokyo and up in Hokkaido. This one I remember of this poor fellow had been unloading a carload of soybeans. And there was a few beans that had fallen down into cracks. And when he thought somebody wasn't looking, he would put them in his pocket. And so he did, and the guard caught him.
Mm.
Well, he took him to his commanding officer, and the commanding officer finally beat him for a while, and then he took and he tied a string onto his penis, and then he led this man around naked in the campground for everyone to see. And he had a wooden sword, which he shoved up this man's rectum. And the poor guy survived all of this. Now, this is one of many. And another one, they sent a big group of them up to the island of Hokkaido, which is very far north. It gets cold, very cold up there. And they had them working in these mines, mining coal.
Mm-hmm.
They lived in these barracks unheated. They would march them out at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning to the mines, where they would go down in the mines and work in waist-deep water, mining coal, till 5, 6 o'clock at night, bring them out, march them home, dripping wet in the icy, cold weather. I don't see how those fellows survived.
I am so amazed. And we've had some survivors of the Bataan Death March and ex-POWs who went through some of those atrocities you describe on this show, and I'm so amazed by the will to survive that they displayed, how they managed to lose more than half their body weight in some instances and survive. And for those of you listening at home, I apologize for some of the graphic nature of this discussion, but I think it is important to understand how brutal this was for these prisoners. And as you describe this, you are typing all of this stuff down on paper. And did it ever get to you? I'm sure it had to turn your stomach, maybe even make tears come to your eyes at some time. Were you ever affected by the nature of what you had to type on that paper?
Oh, yes. I sometimes got so shook up that I just couldn't stand it. But then after a while, I got so that, you know, when you type, you sometimes don't even remember what you type.
Right.
Because you go through it so fast. And so a lot of that just left my mind. But these are two that stand out in my mind that I thought were, one especially, was very cruel.
Did you ever find instances, and we're going to have to take our final break here in a moment, but did you ever find instances that maybe surprised you? I imagine a lot of what you were typing up was to make the case for war crimes, so maybe you didn't hear so many of the positive stories of how some of the captors showed some kindness to the prisoners. Is that fair to say that those instances wouldn't really come across your desk because of the nature of what you were doing?
Well, I never saw any depositions that showed kindness towards the prisoner of war. Not one.
Well, and again, the purpose really for what you were doing was to build the case for war crimes against some of those who had perpetrated the atrocities, right?
Yeah, that's right. Because when the war was over, all of these officers in the military and in the naval, they split. They left, and they went. A lot of them went back to their own homes and hid out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the legal section had investigators who went out with the interpreters, and they found these guys and brought them back. And they locked them up. We had a big prison there where we had Tojo and Tokyo Rose in there. And that's where they were kept until they were taken down to trial.
Well, and I think that's a perfect point to break, because you would end up being involved in taking some of these prisoners down to trial. We're going to talk about that when we come back. Kenneth Lopke, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Just a few minutes left on the program today. Remember, Bulldog football tonight against San Jose State. Pre-game coverage on KMJ starts at 4:30. But we're going to spend the rest of this hour continuing to talk about World War II, the aftermath of World War II, which is when some of the most interesting experiences for Kenneth Lopke came into play. He's 87 years old now, makes his home in Woodland. But back in 1946, he was in Japan. You heard him talk about typing up the depositions of American prisoners of war, testifying to the atrocities committed against them by their Japanese captors. You also mentioned the prison there, not too far from where you were, in which Tojo, many of the Japanese generals, Tokyo Rose, and other prisoners were held. And when you were typing up all these depositions, did you have any idea that you would end up coming in contact with some of these perpetrators of these great atrocities?
No, I didn't know at the time, but I knew some of the other people in the office would go occasionally and transport prisoners, so I figured I would be coming up one of the times to do that.
And I'm sure as you're typing up these depositions, and there's some pretty solid proof corroborated by many different prisoners of the same kind of actions, that it started to become clear a lot of these people were going to be executed, right?
That's right.
So tell me about how you first came to escort prisoners to these trials, and what, if all, you remember about who those people were.
We got notice that a fellow officer in the legal section and I, we were to transfer for these four prisoners down to Manila, and they make out orders for you to go and arrange transportation. And so one morning about 4 o'clock in the morning, we were going out to Sagamo Prison and picking these prisoners up, taking them to an airport where we had MacArthur's flight crew and an old C-47 transport plane, and we all got into that and headed out for Manila. The reason we had MacArthur's flight crew is because they needed to get some flight time, because they weren't doing much since they had gotten to Japan. So it took us till lunchtime to go to Okinawa, and then it took about another 4 hours after that to get to Manila, where we turned the prisoners over to our division down there, and their guards took them away to prison and eventually their trials.
How did you feel about that task? It seems a little bit morbid, but at the same time, very important when you think about the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. Well, from what we had heard, most of the prisoners that went from there down to Manila never came back.
Right. So you hear the cliche, and it was the title of a movie, of course, and a very different scenario, but dead man walking is the phrase that comes to mind, and that's really what these prisoners were as you escorted them. What did you have any interactions with them at all, or did you try not to look them in the eye?
About all we did was escort them to the bathrooms to make sure that they didn't commit hara-kiri or something like that, and that's about as close as we got to them.
And were you aware of what these particular prisoners were accused of?
No.
Probably better that way, huh?
Yeah. Anything that happened in the Philippines, we didn't have too much to do with, but anything that happened in Japan proper itself, that went across our desk.
Gotcha. So that was another thing that obviously you can't forget. A trip like that kind of sticks in your memory. But
yeah.
All this time you're looking forward to a little bit longer trip that would have a little happier ending to it. When did you finally get to come home? And tell me, once you did get home and you saw Adeline again, how did you ask her to marry you?
How did I?
Yeah. Well, first tell me when this was, when you finally got to come home, and then you can segue into how you popped that question.
Okay.
If you remember. Don't want to get you in trouble
about
now.
About the last of September in 1946, I got orders to leave Japan. We left on a large-sized boat. It was an Italian luxury liner.
All right.
It was a great big ship that the United States government had taken over from Italy. And it took us a couple of weeks to cross from Tokyo to San Francisco. And then from there I went up to Fort Lewis, Washington, and was discharged there. And then took the train home from Seattle to Aberdeen, South Dakota, where Adeline and my folks and my sisters were waiting for me. And that was the highlight of my coming home.
I imagine you'd been envisioning that sight for quite a while.
Yes.
So you proposed right there on the spot, or you waited a few weeks?
Oh, no. It was like in November then, and I think after the first of the year, somewhere along in there, I proposed to her. No, I proposed to her before that, but then it was shortly after the beginning of the year that we got married on February 11th, 1947.
So 62 years later, you're still together.
Yep.
And would she verify everything that you've told me so far today?
Oh, sure.
Boy, life's been pretty good to you. Sounds like somebody was looking out for you.
Yeah.
We just have a couple minutes left in the program. Was there anything else from your time in the service that really stands out that you think people ought to know about?
Well, not really. I did hook up with my Army buddy that I left for the service with. We finally got together in Tokyo. And that was a surprise.
So that was a pretty good reunion, too, for you.
Sure. And then we hoped to go home in the same boat, but they lost my papers, so I didn't get to go home with him, and I got home a couple weeks later than he did.
Well, I guess when you get home, you're not going to complain too much because you did get home. Let me ask you this. You talked about typing up all those depositions, and obviously you have read and heard about a lot of things that a lot of us haven't. Do you think that people today understand what went on and how horrible an experience American prisoners of war on the whole had to deal with in the Pacific?
That's right. And, you know, you can have access to those records now from the National Archives if you just write to them in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
and ask for records of the legal section of MacArthur's headquarters. You can get some of that.
We can even see what it looked like coming from your typewriter, I bet.
Probably.
Well, Mr. Lopke, thanks so much for taking time for us today. I'm sorry that the time has gone away from us already here, but thank you for serving our country and for sharing those incredible memories with us today.
Thank you very much. for thinking of me and letting me be on your program.
The privilege was all mine. That's Kenneth Lopke. He's been our guest today. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.